So last week I talked about postmodernism. I introduced the topic of postmodernism and I discussed Jean-François Lyotard. That was the first philosopher I wanted to discuss under the heading of the postmodern. We talked about the sublime, and today I would like to shift the focus to another French philosopher whose name is Jacques Derrida. I will also talk about Sarat Maharaj. The first one, Jacques Derrida, is arguably the most famous postmodern and post-structuralist philosopher. The second one, Sarat Maharaj, is a curator and a writer who is still alive and active today. He is quite influenced by Derrida, not only by Derrida, but especially for the concepts I want to introduce today, and those concepts are deconstruction and untranslatability. Especially for the last concept, untranslatability, we will see how the thinking of Sarat Maharaj is quite close to the topics introduced by Derrida. You will need to study the last chapter of this class, which is dedicated to the philosophy of technology, by yourself. Okay, so chapter 10, philosophy of technology, you will have to study by yourself. There is a tool you can use to help you. I would like you to watch a short video, it's only 10 minutes, I guess, by the American stone carver Nick Benson. I will put a link on Digitab so you can easily find it. It's really good. It's Nick Benson talking about the craft of stone carving, and I hope it's useful for you. Let's get started with Derrida. Let me tell you something about his life first. The French-Algerian philosopher Jacques Derrida grew up in colonial Algeria. He was born in El Biar, it's a suburb of Alger, the capital of Algeria, in the year 1930. His family was originally Jewish. Since the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and Portugal in the 15th century, there had always been a considerable Jewish community in Algeria. In the year 1870, the Algerian Jews received the French nationality. That brought the Jewish community, culturally speaking, closer to the French colonists. But their new privileges, as compared to the native Algerians, Islamic Algerians, turned out to be short-lived. During the Second World War, the anti-Semitic laws of Vichy France, which collaborated with Nazi Germany, were applied more stringently in Algeria than in France itself. Algerian Jews, as a consequence, again lost their civil rights. As a young boy, for example, Derrida was sent away from school for a while because of his Jewish origins. After the Second World War, the Algerian Jews renewed their allegiance to France. When Algeria became independent in 1962, the majority of them moved to France together with the former colonists. Derrida had already moved to Paris on his own by that time in order to go to secondary school. Like other thinkers of his generation, such as Alain Badiou or Pierre Bourdieu, he attended higher secondary education at the Lyceum Louis le Grand in Paris. He passed his third attempt for the entrance exam of the famous École Normale Supérieure, where he studied literature and philosophy. Just like his fellow student Michel Foucault, who was his senior by 4 years, Derrida came under the influence of the Marxist thinker Louis Althusser while studying at the École Normale Supérieure. His own position was also, his own political position, I mean, was also clearly on the left side of the spectrum. On a philosophical level, he felt strongly attracted to phenomenology. In the academic year 1953-1954, Derrida traveled to the University of Leuven, here in Belgium, in order to study the manuscripts of the German philosopher in the newly founded Husserl archive. Husserl was at the center of Derrida's research during the first years of his philosophical career. He received his philosophy degree on the basis of a thesis about the phenomenologist's work. In the same period, he translated Husserl's unpublished text Die Frage nach dem Ursprung der Geometrie als intentional-historisches Problem, usually known under the title The Origin of Geometry, from 1939. In that text, Husserl dealt with the problem of how geometrical insights arose in the mind before they were put into words. And Husserl believed that such insights first existed in an idealistic way and were only afterwards expressed in language. So first you had some kind of pre-language consciousness of certain mathematical insights. Only afterwards would you find the words to express them. Derrida received the scientific award for his edition of Husserl's text, but more importantly, the work also led him to a fundamentally new philosophical position. He could not reconcile himself with Husserl's position anymore. According to Derrida, thinking was always, even from its earliest existence, bound to its expression in words. As he put it in a famous quote from his book De la Grammatologie, Of Grammatology, from 1967, there is nothing outside the text. This has become a famous Derrida quote. Il n'y a pas de hors texte. There is nothing outside the text. After his graduation, Derrida had to complete his military service in Algeria. During that period, and we're now talking about the period of 1957-58, the country was in the midst of a bloody war of independence. This is the time of post-colonialism, of decolonization. Derrida was assigned a position as teacher of children of military personnel, and he regularly met his former fellow student Pierre Bourdieu while staying in Algeria. Just before leaving for Algeria, Derrida had married his wife Marguerite Aucouturier. She became well known herself as a psychoanalyst for her translations of important psychoanalytical texts, such as the books of the Austrian-British therapist Melanie Klein. Together with Aucouturier, Derrida had two sons. Let me now shift to the beginning of his philosophical career. Back in France, after his military service, Derrida worked as an assistant at the Sorbonne in the early 1960s and afterwards also at the École Normale Supérieure. He had also started his doctoral research under the guidance of the well-known French philosopher Jean Hippolyte. His PhD project, in the beginning, built on his earlier work on Husserl. But Derrida got sidetracked. He turned away from the conception of philosophy as a strict science. This was the idea that Husserl had advocated. Philosophy should be conducted in a rigorous way, actually quite close to how scientists work. Don't forget, Husserl was trained both as a mathematician and as a philosopher. So Derrida decided to change his environment, to leave the environment of academic philosophy and to go to semiotics and literary studies, which were at that time highly active fields. He became friends with young French intellectuals and writers such as Philippe Solers, Hélène Sisu, and Julia Kristeva. They belonged to the circle of the journals Critique and Tel Quel. Both periodicals explored the border area between a new post-structuralist theory and experimental literature. At the end of the 1960s, the young philosopher Derrida abandoned his doctoral research project. In fact, after 1972, he would not write about Husserl anymore and only rarely referred to his work. In the meantime, his interests were oriented towards completely different authors. These were often literary writers, such as Antonin Artaud or Maurice Blanchot, or authors situated between literature and philosophy. Think of Friedrich Nietzsche or Georges Bataille. His essays on these thinkers were collected in one of his first books, called L'écriture et la différence, Writing and Difference, from 1967. Derrida had actually gone through a major crisis regarding his role within the institution of academic philosophy. From now on, he deliberately chose an unorthodox style of thinking and writing. In this way, he deliberately opposed the science-based language used usually by academic philosophers. Think, for instance, of an example we have already discussed in this course at the beginning, in October, I guess, the book Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, by Ludwig Wittgenstein. That book, one of the most famous books of philosophy of the 20th century, was deliberately written in the style of a book of mathematics, using strictly numbered statements. This was this science-based style of philosophizing that I referred to. And Derrida, together with other philosophers such as Lyotard, such as Baudrillard, were quite hostile to that. they felt that this was not the only way of doing philosophy. Let me give you an example. Take Derrida's book Glace. Glace is a book from 1974, and the book combined three very different texts, all written by Derrida, which were distributed over three columns on a square format page. There is an image of this book in the slides. In the left column, you would get his interpretation, Derrida's interpretation, of a book by the German 19th century philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, while the right column displayed his comments on the autobiographical work of the contemporary French author Jean Genet. In the middle column were quotes from the books themselves and from other reference works. So, as a reader, you had to make a choice how to read the different texts, reading each text column separately in its entirety, so going through the entire book but reading only one column, or you could jump from column to column and read it page by page. In each case, it was unavoidable that the different lines of thought would start infecting each other. It would be a kind of derailed reading, unavoidably. Derrida was also not afraid of a personal and almost capricious approach of the great philosophers of the past. For instance, his book from 1980, La carte postale de Socrate à Freud et au-delà, which you can translate as The Postcard from Socrates to Freud and Beyond, was undeniably a philosophy book. It was a book about philosophy. But the author also included personal letters and postcards in the book. The method with which Derrida approached the philosophical tradition became known as deconstruction. And deconstruction does certainly not mean destruction of traditional philosophy. It is rather a specific reading strategy. The French philosopher wanted to keep the interpretation of a certain text open for as long as possible. He questioned the presumed unique meaning or interpretation of a text. His method implied that the process of finding the meaning of a text ought to be slowed down. He found it necessary to show which were the multiple meanings of a text, and he was always suspicious about a definitive interpretation, because this would mean that you would close the process of signification, of the generation of meaning of the text. Deconstruction as a method introduced paradoxes and ambiguities into Derrida's style of writing. He demonstrated how classical texts from the philosophical tradition were much more layered than was usually assumed. But his experimental and literary approach also caused problems later. For instance, in 1991, Pierre Bourdieu lobbied for Derrida to become a professor at the Collège de France. That's the highest academic institution in France. But this met with strong opposition from other French philosophers. American and British analytical thinkers also fiercely criticized his methods. They accused him of obscurantism, of deliberately obscuring a lucid style of thinking. And according to these philosophers, Derrida wrote in a deliberately imprecise and confused style. In 1992, a number of Cambridge professors successfully boycotted the honorary doctorate that the University of Cambridge was going to bestow on Derrida. Meanwhile, his fame in other places of the intellectual landscape just continued to rise. In addition to his work as a lecturer at the École Normale Supérieure, he also accepted guest professorships at various American universities, including Yale and Cornell. He also used his reputation in the academic world in order to further political and social aims. He opposed, among other things, the attempts by the French government to reform the teaching of philosophy in secondary schools. In 1981, he supported an initiative to help dissident intellectuals in Soviet-controlled Czechoslovakia. During one trip to the country, drugs were hidden in his luggage, so he could be arrested at the border during a customs check. The French president at that time, François Mitterrand, had to intervene in order to accomplish his release. In his personal life, Derrida had a third son, Daniel Agachinsky, who was born in 1984. His mother was the French philosopher Sylviane Agachinsky, with whom Derrida had an extramarital relationship. However, Derrida never divorced from his wife Marguerite Couturier, who was aware of the relationship. During the last decade of his life, Derrida increasingly shifted the focus of his work to political and ethical issues. He published on issues such as hospitality, terrorism, especially state terrorism, and the legacy of Marxism. In the year 2003, Derrida was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He died the following year in Paris at the age of 74. His wife, Marguerite Couturier, died in Paris last month on March 21, 2020, from a COVID-19 infection at the age of 87. Good. Let me now have a look at some fundamental concepts from the philosophy of Derrida. Three key concepts are deconstruction, dissemination, and difference, différence. I will start with the second concept, dissemination. An early essay by Derrida about the French surrealist poet and theatre director Antonin Artaud offers a good case of what dissemination could mean. In the early 1960s, Derrida published two essays on Artaud. They are both included in his book Writing and Difference. Let me walk you through one of these essays. The starting point of these essays is Artaud's observation that his thinking is withdrawing from himself. Maybe I should say that Artaud, by the time Derrida was writing these essays, had already died. Artaud was a famous poet and collaborator of the Surrealist movement. He came to prominence in the 1920s, 1930s. He was at first a friend of André Breton, the leader of Surrealism, and later had a quite violent falling out with Breton. Artaud was diagnosed as a psychiatric patient in the late 1930s, and he would spend the following 12 years in psychiatric confinement. And only after the Second World War, in the year 1947, he was eventually released from psychiatry and did the 12-year stay there, together with his drug addiction. He was addicted to morphine, would leave its mark. And he actually died the following year, 1948. So that's Artaud. Let's see what Derrida has to say about this poet. So the poet Artaud puts this experience that his thinking is withdrawing from himself into words in a correspondence begun in 1924. The correspondence is between Artaud and Jacques Rivière. Rivière was the editor of the prestigious literary magazine La Nouvelle Revue Française, and Rivière had just refused a selection of poems submitted by Artaud. Artaud immediately replied. He said, "These are not just poems. It is about much more. I'm sending you much more than mere poetry. I need to write these poems. My mental health is at stake." And in what followed, Artaud described the special relationship he has with his own writings. Every time he thinks, there is a kind of theft taking place. He tries to crystallize his living, amorphous thought into words, sentences, poems, and texts, but then he has to witness how the words come out of his mouth or of his pen like a strange, petrified object. The author, in other words, no longer recognizes what he has written or said. There is a certain something that is constantly squeezing itself into the gap between the speaker and what he says. Derrida takes this experience as the starting point for a philosophical diagnosis of Artaud's illness. Expressing myself is equal to being betrayed to myself. The means of betrayal is that which at first had seemed to be a gift, namely the gift of expression. In reality, however, I can never arrive at really expressing myself. As soon as I speak, I am plagiarized. There is always a stealing god who attempts to steal the words from my mouth and appropriate them for himself. The dream of being with myself through self-expression, of fully expressing myself, of coinciding with myself by saying what I am, of who I am, or expressing who I really am, turns out to be an illusion. With every expression of myself, Artaud feels, I'm falling outside of myself. I am not present in what I say. I merely represent a false image of myself. As soon as I start to speak, I no longer recognize myself in what I have said. I am not present in what I say, but I merely represent a false image of myself. Let me quote a few paragraphs from this essay of Derrida on Artaud, so you get the feeling for his writing style. I quote, "Ever since I have had a relation to my body, therefore, ever since my birth, I no longer am my body. Ever since I have had a body, I am not this body, hence I do not possess it. This deprivation institutes and informs my relation to my life. My body has thus always been stolen from me. Who could have stolen it from me, if not an other, and how could he have gotten hold of it from the beginning, unless he had slipped into my place inside my mother's belly, unless I had been stolen from birth, unless my birth had been purloined from me? And who could be the thief, if not the great invisible other, the furtive persecutor, who doubles me everywhere, that is, redoubles and surpasses me, always arrives before me where I have chosen to go? Who could he be, if not God? God is thus the proper name of that which deprives us of our own nature, of our own birth. Consequently, he will always have spoken before us, on the sly. He is the difference which insinuates itself between myself and myself as my death. This is why, such is the concept of the true suicide, according to Artaud, I must die away from my death in order to be reborn immortal, so to speak, at the eve of my birth." End of quote. You can see how the writing style of Derrida is quite literary. He is actually very close to how Artaud is writing. I have now chosen these paragraphs, but actually the essay of Artaud, of Derrida, I mean, is full of quotes from Artaud. Let me now show you which philosophical conclusions Derrida is drawing from this. With the distinction made by Artaud between presence and representation, Derrida can make the transition from Artaud's poetic struggles to his career in theater and film. During the interwar period, Artaud was a familiar face on the Parisian theater stage and on the big screen. But at the same time, he also had an aversion to the mainstream theater of his time. Artaud wrote fierce manifestos calling for a complete reform of the stage. The traditional talk theater had to be done away with. Instead, Artaud called for what he described as a physical, tangible stage language. Why this hostility with regard to the spoken word on the stage? The theater, namely, is the perfect art of representation. The actor repeats the words that were first written down by a playwright. The writer then is the first prompter thief. He is like the thieving god who squeezes between the speaker and his words. No wonder that the actor can count on little respect. Within Derrida's presentation of Artaud, he is referred to, the actor I mean, as a slave or even a beast of burden of the playwright and the theatre director. Nevertheless, Artaud did look for an escape route within the theatre. It seems possible to break away from the dictatorship of representation, and that can happen, paradoxically enough, precisely at the theatre, just there where representation is rampant. In the kind of theatre that Artaud is dreaming of, life itself is present in its very unrepresentability. How could that be possible? How do you have to imagine this kind of protest against representation? Well, through the technique of screaming, for example. At the end of his life, Artaud was constantly writing and performing concrete poetry and nonsensical poetry. A famous lecture by him from 1947 consisted of poems and texts that regularly derailed into vocal experiments. The shrieks and wails of their author, who had just recently been released from psychiatric care, actually disquieted the audience, and eventually the writer André Gide had to step onto the stage in order to help Artaud. This self-destructive coincidence of life and art can indeed be read as the pursuit of pure self-presentation. The scream has a unicity that is not available in writing. It almost eludes the semiotic scheme, which, according to Ferdinand de Saussure, unambiguously connects a sign to its meaning. Artaud strives for a sort of pure voice, an expression in which the word seems to be glued to the throat during screaming. adhering to the vocalizing body. The meaning is the sign. What the poet has to say is his voice, is his body. Artaud's attempt to escape the domain of representation led to bewildered readers and listeners of his work. What remains to be interpreted here? How should I listen or how should I read these kind of texts, this kind of derailing products? The sounds that should form words and thus meanings become independent. Semiotics is breaking down. With this, Artaud demonstrated an extreme version of a strategy that Derrida will apply in his own text, and he calls it dissemination. The intention is to introduce polysemy, or the multiplicity of meaning. Polysémie is how he calls it. This versatility is characteristic of every text in the eyes of Derrida, but it is often blocked by readers. They constrain the text into a unique and lucid interpretation. Derrida, on the other hand, maintains that the text is never finished or closed. As a reader of the philosophical canon, you cannot restrict yourself to a supposed definitive meaning of the text. Text should rather remain open to the continuing generation of new meanings. Keeping a text open requires a special way of philosophizing and a special kind of writing. Hence Derrida's quite labyrinthine style, for which he has often been criticized. For the philosopher, that writing style was essential in order not to resolve contradictions, but to let them live on. This attempt is also described as the work of différence, and now I come to a new concept, another concept of Derrida, différence. It is quite impossible to translate this concept, since Derrida is actually making a pun. The pun is on a French word which is normally written differently. So différence, Derrida writes it with an A, while normally you would write it with an E. Différence has two E's. But if you write it différence with an A, it sounds the same, but it looks different. It is a concept, therefore, that only exists when it is read, and of which no trace remains in the written language, in the spoken language. From a philosophical point of view, différence involves the continuous postponement and thus making impossible of the sublation of opposites. A synthesis between thesis and antithesis cannot take place. There always remains a difference. This brings me to a description of the methodology of deconstruction. Anyone who deconstructs a text constantly shoves out the differences in front of him and refuses to sublate them into a synthesis. Derrida seems to be intensely focused on written text, but his approach is actually also applicable to visual arts. A good case are the portraits and self-portraits that Antonin Artaud created during the last years of his life. These were only exhibited for the first time in 1996 at the New York Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, almost half a century after the death of Artaud. On that occasion, Derrida held a lecture which was later published as Artaud le MoMA, Artaud de MoMA. Artaud's drawings are quite special. The portraits, made in pencil and crayon, show rough lines imposed over one another that trace the facial features of the portrait person time and again. Furthermore, the drawing's material support, most often paper, is intentionally damaged by Artaud. The paper is stained, and Artaud also burned holes in it with his cigarettes. He pierced the drawings or partially burnt them. The special graphic character of his work is underlined by the name given to it by the artist. It was not about making portraits, it was about making spells, meant to ward off evil. The graphic work of Artaud actually embodies the aim of the deconstruction itself. Deconstruction means to follow a text's line of argument and simultaneously going against the grain of it. Just like Artaud simultaneously produces and destroys his graphic work. According to Derrida, that transforms them into highly unstable works of art. Already in his early essays, Derrida had written that Artaud strives for an art without artworks. Let me give you a quote. "For what his howls promise us is the meaning of an art prior to madness and the work, an art which no longer yields works, an artist's existence which is no longer a root or an experience that gives access to something other than itself. The critic and the doctor are without resource when confronted by an existence that refuses to signify, or by an art without works, language without trace. End of quote. But if this is an art that destroys itself, does it make sense to present the works in an expensive exhibition at a prestigious location like the MoMA? Is that not the ultimate threat to a figure like Artaud, that he will become part of the Western canon, that his works will increase in value on the international art market, that his rebellious reputation gives an extra boost to the MoMA's international standing? Derrida recognizes this criticism, but he still underlines that the works endanger the foundations of the art world, the museum, and the Western canon of art. Okay, that's what I wanted to tell you about Derrida specifically. Now let me move to a quite different figure, whose name is Sarath Maharai. Maharai is a South African author and curator. He was born in Durban in 1951, and his family was part of the large group of Indians who migrated to the province of KwaZulu-Natal in the 19th century, coming from India. The grandfather of Maharai actually worked in sugar plantations as a contract worker. That was a colonial system. Contract work, a system of indentured labor, which was similar to slavery in many ways. As a child, Maharai witnessed the effects of racial segregation under the apartheid regime. Separate areas of the city were designated for each of the four population groups recognized by the racial classification system. So you had blacks, whites, Indians, and colored people. The classification soon ran into problems. Who was to be placed in which box? How light or how dark did your skin color have to be in order to fit in a certain group? What about families of mixed origin? As Maharai explains, the South African apartheid system had no real concept of hybridity, of interracial marriage. It was forbidden, but it was also not conceivable in the racist logic of apartheid. Given that all social institutions in South Africa, including schools and universities, used this system, a change in racial status could have major consequences for a family. During his university studies, Maharai had to travel by ferry to the University College for Indians, which was located on Salisbury Island off the coast of Durban. And these experiences made him very sensitive to the violence that is inherently present in classification systems. As a young man, Maharai traveled to Britain. He received refugee status and started art studies at Goldsmiths College in London. In 1980, he started his doctoral research at the same institution. It was entitled The Dialectic of Modernism and Mass Culture, Studies on Post-War British Art. His later research focused on the Irish writer James Joyce, the British artist Richard Hamilton, and the French artist Marcel Duchamp. Maharai remained at Goldsmiths until 2005 as a teacher of art history and art theory. He also worked as a researcher at the Jan van Eyck Academy in Maastricht and as a visiting professor at Humboldt University in Berlin. Today, he's holding a chair in visual art and knowledge systems at University of Lund in Sweden, that's the Art Academy of Malmö. He is a member of the editorial staff of Third Text, an academic journal devoted to art within the global context. In addition to his academic work, Maharai also regularly worked as a curator. Among other things, he was the co-curator of Documenta 11 in 2002 and of the Biennial of Sao Paulo in 2010. In his essays and lectures, Sarath Maharai returned time and again to the topic of intercultural difference. His thinking is obviously indebted to his personal background and hybrid identity. That was also the case for other thinkers who developed their ideas against the background of post-colonialism, such as Edward Said. But in the case of Maharai, it's also important to point out two important tendencies occurring around the year 2000. A first tendency was the globalization of the art market. Since the 1990s, artists, collectors, and museums from countries outside of Europe and North America, particularly from emerging countries such as China and Brazil, but also from the Middle East, are playing an increasingly prominent role in the international art world. On the one hand, the Western art system is often indiscriminately taken over by these new actors. Think of events such as the Singapore Biennial or the Art Dubai Art Fair, which are set up just like Western biennials or art fairs. On the other hand, globalization also ensures that cultural differences in art become more conspicuous. A typical example is the censorship and other government actions against Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. Such incidents frequently led to reactions of outrage from the Western art world. A second phenomenon which you need to understand Maharai's work concerns the insights of postmodernism and deconstructionist thought. These currents created a conceptual framework within which it became possible to better think about and appreciate cultural difference. A philosophy such as that of Lyotard or Derrida assumes that such differences are of fundamental importance. It is a pointless ambition to reduce or even eliminate difference. What is more, the philosophical strategy of deconstruction attempts to keep open the tensions that are inherent in a given text or a particular work of art. Maharai calls for caution. He wonders whether the thinkers of the 1990s, including himself, have not been too optimistic about producing difference. The international space, the international intercultural meeting space, was perhaps too easily understood, and now I quote, as the meeting ground for a multiplicity of tongues, visual grammars, and styles, end of quote. All those cultural differences were welcomed instead of being erased. The danger that Maharai observes is that the mutual translatability of difference is too often taken for granted. Is it not too easily presupposed that cultures are, as it were, transparent to each other? I quote, where translation is understood as a process of carrying over and simply in terms of transparency, it tends to encourage a superficial, if seductive, attitude to multicultural translation as the immediate visibility of all elements of multicultural community to one another, even in the face of an adverse actuality that thwarts and distresses such an ideal at every turn. End of quote. What Maharai demands attention for is the opacity of difference. Cultures are not transparent to each other. On the contrary, they often raise barriers that prove sticky or difficult. What does that mean for the translator or for other cultural intermediaries? They will have to try to bridge difference and translate untranslatable sensitivities from one culture to another. In doing so, they will become entangled in the difficult hybrid domain between two or more cultures. Maharai pleads to see that struggle as a creative force. It is not the transparency, but rather the opacity of cultures that creates something new. A topic that occupies Maharai in recent years is that of the artist's archive. From his South African background, however, he's still deeply distrustful of the process of systematizing and classifying, which often goes hand in hand with the act of archiving. Classification systems are inherently violent. They put the chaotic, troublesome reality in neat boxes, just like the drawers of a filing cabinet. The notion of the archive has been high on the agenda of philosophers and artists since the end of the last century. One reason was the publication of Mal d'Archive, or Archive Fever, a book by Jacques Derrida in 1995. The French philosopher emphasizes in that book that archives are not neutral records of lives or careers. On the contrary, ever since psychoanalysis, we know that the way in which people structure and remember the past is highly variable and subjective. This also applies to the physical record of that past in archives. The central theme of Derrida's book is that the archive designer is intimately involved in the archive, and also the archivist and the researcher who makes use of it. Anyone handling an archive will also become part of it. I quote from Derrida's book, "The interpretation of the archive can only illuminate, read, interpret, establish its object, namely a given inheritance, by inscribing itself into it, that is to say, by opening it and by enriching it enough to have a rightful place in it. There is no meta-archive." End of quote. The reflections of Maharai also go against established notions of what archives should be, what they should do. His starting point is an archive which he composed himself, together with art students from Goldsmiths College. They collected documents about the presence of immigrants in Great Britain. Maharai did not want to name it an archive, but rather a non-archive. He wanted to counteract the dominant tendency of dividing people into categories such as native and immigrant, legal and illegal, migrant and expat. In the end, he chose to name it the Vegan Archive. Why? Well, according to Maharaj, the archivist's urge to divide everything into concepts is an essentially carnivorous drive. Linguistic concepts are eating the world. Maharaj sees a relationship between the butcher's ability to cut a carcass with as little loss as possible and the philosopher's skill dividing the world into concepts. The Vegan Archive, on the other hand, ambitions to be aconceptual. It does not want to slaughter the archive documents by locking them up in a taxonomy, but keeping them alive. I quote from Maharaj's text, "Difficult as the term might be to begin with, we should think of a kind of evolution from the carnivorous archive, the all-consuming archive that eats everything, captures everything, and draws it into the mold of the structure of the archive, to a non-carnivorous archive, which might be a vegetarian archive, or, as I am boldly dogmatic, I shall call the Vegan Archive." End of quote. There is a clear relationship with Derrida's ideas about how the interpretation of an archive always becomes part of the archive by inscribing itself into it. Maharaj wants to get rid of the Eurocentric idea that an archive should be static and unchangeable. As an example, he points to the Indian tradition of reciting. Professional reciters memorize all major Hindu writings. That includes not only the long narrative poems, such as the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and the philosophical religious Vedas, but also the many comments that have been added over the centuries. It goes without saying that the oral and improvising way in which a reciter continues and transforms the Hindu tradition is starkly different from the Western concept of cultural heritage. In the Western view, protecting the authentic document is of preeminent importance. Conservation techniques must protect the original object against every possible change inflicted on it by contemporary users. And Maharaj takes a different position. I give you one last quote. "I hope you can see that this is a larger thematic, out of which I am carving out this clip, which is from the Vegan Archive. It looks at the archive as a passage from past into future. The archive ostensibly is about the past, but actually it's all about the future. This is one of the odd things about it." End of quote. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. Good luck with the juries. I wish you all the best, and I hope to see you again.